From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for September 20th, 2019. There's a lot of stuff happening this weekend. Take your pick from the 45th Annual Holy Hill Arts and Crafts Fair, or just down the road, the Holy Hill Art and Farm Market. There's also Cedarburg's Wine and Harvest Festival, where my wife is playing, specifically at the Cedarburg Art Museum Beer Garden on Sunday from 3 to 6. The Packers host the Denver Broncos also on Sunday, which I will miss because apparently I'm the roadie and sound man for Lisa Edgar and Razzmatazz. Geez, I hope she pays me. And finally, the Pirates are in town for the Brewers' last homestand for 2019. All right, picturesque San Piero Patte, a town of 3,000 in sun-drenched Sicily, is trying to bring new life to the area by selling abandoned houses for less than a shot of espresso. Mamma mia, you can't get that kind of deal in Monopoly or at Starbucks. And apparently Russians are drinking too much vodka and having too much sex. I didn't know that was a problem, but Russian Orthodox priests think so. For the past 10 years, they would fly over the small town of Tver and sprinkle holy water from a small airplane. It seems to be working on the drinking half of the equation, but they're still having lots of sober sex. In the studio today, we have Brian Kilb, Mark Amateus, Isabel Wymero, Joel Dreesang, and getting us started, here's Kyle Tedding.
Thanks, Max. A busy week in the news as a weekend attack cut Saudi Arabia's oil production by half. With the oil-rich kingdom accounting for about a tenth of the global oil supply, the price of crude oil spiked about 15% on Monday from Friday's close. Though oil prices have stabilized, relations with Iran remain an issue as Saudis continue to point to evidence that the country was behind the attacks. On Wednesday, the Federal Reserve cut the federal funds rate for the second time in a decade. While Fed minutes continue to point to the strengths of low unemployment, Fed Chair Jerome Powell has also commented on concerns that the trade war may hurt economic growth. With a target for the federal funds rate now standing at 1.75 to 2%, bank instruments like certificates of deposit and money markets have seen declining rates as well. After rallying a bit earlier in the month to erase the inversion of the 10-year and 2-year treasury, the rate on the 10-year treasury declined a bit this week, falling back near the rate on the 2-year treasury. Despite a rocky start to the week and some rising geopolitical tensions, it's been a fairly quiet stretch for stocks so far in September after a rocky August. The S&P 500 has now traded 2.5 weeks within 30 points of 3,000, and the last 8 days within a third of a percent of that 3,000 number as well. So as I said, a pretty quiet stretch for stocks despite some recent tough news. And that's maybe a quick look at the week. I think important to point out, you know, you look at the numbers for the week, the NASDAQ down just 0.7% this week, closing at 8,118. The S&P 500 down 0.5%, closing at 29.92. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average closes the week at 26,934, down 1% for the week. And then, of course, the yield on the 10-year Treasury moving from 1.9% to start the week down to 1.76% at the close today. And that's maybe a quick look at the week. Mark, a lot to talk about, obviously.
Yeah, Kyle, it seems we're always talking about the Fed. And this week, of course, as you mentioned, they lowered the Fed funds rate by 0.25 to a range of 1.75 to 2%. What does that really mean to investors, though? Give us your feelings on why an investor should care about that.
Yeah, you know, I think first and foremost, as we look at kind of the direction now that the Fed has chosen for the overnight rate, bringing it back down, being a little more accommodative, getting some indications from, for example, the president of the Boston Federal Reserve this week that perhaps there are some concerns about being overly accommodative, that, you know, the goal of lowering rates is to stimulate economic growth. The goal of lowering rates is to get people to go out and maybe put money into riskier assets rather than just leaving it in safe treasuries, rather than just leaving it in that overnight lending rate, getting banks to lend, getting corporations to spend money rather than leave it on their balance sheets. And I think that the problem is we've had such a long stretch of positive returns, such a long stretch of What's been low enough rates that we should have seen that kind of stimulus already? The president of the Boston Fed came out and suggested that maybe we're encouraging, you know, riskier approaches to investing than what we should be seeing right now. Maybe it would make more sense to be a little more defensive, let rates stay a little higher, cause people maybe to maybe take a little bit less risk. And so I think what you're seeing is a little bit now of a couple of members of the Federal Reserve that are less willing to go along with what the Fed's been doing. You know, you had two votes dissenting this week on the Fed's move because they disagreed with direction. You had one more dissenting, though, in Dudley, who suggested that maybe we should have gone a little farther. And so I think it's interesting as we look at kind of what the Fed's doing that there's a variety of opinions out there about what really should be happening and what the impact's going to be.
Well, and you wonder if it's really doing what you want it to do. I mean, at the end of the day, what kind of evidence do we have, and how much talk, you know, do we have about lowering rates and the impact that has when there's already so much money in the system to begin with? So you're kind of like, well, I get that we don't want it to look this way, you know, the optics, as people like to say these days, and we don't want a negative yield curve, and we don't want these other things. I do think, Kyle, what you just said about a couple of dissenting views now is kind of a healthy thing, that you see a couple guys that really didn't want to lower rates more, and you see one guy actually wanted to lower them more than that. And I think that argumentative process now is maybe something that'll be healthy down the road. But I think, you know, for me, I kind of wish, like I think Mario Draghi wishes right now, that we quit talking about, you know, monetary policy and worry more about things that will matter in the long run, such as fiscal policies and those sorts of things. So,
Isabel, I know you did a little bit of research on what happens to the stock market following consecutive rate cuts. Why don't you share with us what you found out?
Yeah, really interesting article I was reading, you know, about how the stock market performs following consecutive rate cuts. What it said is that typically the S&P was up on average 1.74% 1 month following that second rate cut. What was even more interesting, I thought, is that immediately after, typically growth stocks outperform after a second or even a third rate cut. But looking longer term, typically value comes back and ends up being the winner, looking a year out.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about value and growth in a bit, but Joe, I want to bring you in here. There's three reports that had to do with housing this week, and all of them positive. It's kind of something that we've been keeping our eye on for a while. Tell us what you found here.
All right, Mark. Housing is not a real big part of the economy, as far as contributions. We know that consumers make up the bulk of the economic activity, like almost 70%. But housing's a big thing, and it's the biggest expenditure that most consumers make. So that's a really good sign of how consumers are feeling. And we had the one report actually had two numbers, different numbers in it. One's about housing starts, and the other's about building permits. And they are just as they sound. Building permits is more of a forward-looking indicator to see how many people are taking out permits to build houses. And those were both above expectations. The numbers were the highest since before the recession, which that's really encouraging. They're also very volatile, though. It's hard to put a lot of faith in 1 month's numbers. And what they look at is they look at an average annual rate. So that aside, they were good numbers. And that's encouraging. It's good to see that that people are having faith in taking out building permits and building houses. And then the third report was from the National Association of Realtors looking at existing houses. So the other one is new houses, and that's a smaller part of the housing market. Existing houses, as you look around, I mean, that's the bulk of the industry. And that also was positive, and it was up 1.3% from the annual rate that it was in July, and it was up 2.6% above the year ago number. But there's some concern that's being expressed by the realtors that there's not enough of the housing starts. There aren't enough new houses out there, and there's not enough inventory, not enough people who want to sell their houses. So because of a supply-demand, inequality, the price of housing keeps going up. But even with that, The sales went up in August, so that was
Joel, I think I look at that existing home sales number, and it gives you a good idea of the strength of the housing sector. I think, as you mentioned, though, the more important piece, at least in this week's reports, was the permit numbers, the new homes numbers, because that gives you a better idea of the expansion of the inventory. It gives you a better idea of new household formation. And while housing itself isn't a big piece of our economy, as you mentioned, consumption is. And if you're buying a brand new house on the market, that brand new house has to be filled with brand new furniture and brand new microwaves and brand new refrigerators. And, you know, as we've learned in kind of our build out here that we're going through right now, when you start to put all these new things in, that cost adds up pretty quickly. And so, you know, that's going to drive stores like Home Depot or Lowe's. It's, you know, it's going to help their earnings because there's new homes being built. It's going to help you know, all of the various retail outlets that are out there, if we can get some new inventory, if we can continue to see some progress there. And I think for a little while we talked about, you know, a slowing housing market. And so some encouraging signs this week, even if it's just a single week of data.
Right. And one little caveat to throw in there is that those housing permit, the housing starts and the permit numbers, all of those were growing more on multifamily housing units. So there are more, you know, apartment buildings going up than there are houses. Well, not more, but they're rising at a faster rate. So that might speak, and we've brought this up before too, and Bob Landis talked about it at our seminars, is demographics. So that's something to keep an eye on.
Joel, we also got some pretty good numbers on industrial production and capacity utilization.
Right, yeah. So again, you know, manufacturing isn't as big a part of our economy as it used to be, but it's still a very important part. We had been seeing that not looking so good. Earlier in the year, the first 4 months of the year, we had on average every month the industrial production was going down 0.5%. In the last 4 months, it's been going up 0.2%. So it's nice to see a little turnaround there. Not quite sure what the momentum is going to be behind that, because we're talking with, you know, a slowing global economy. We're talking about confusion over tariffs and you know, trade wars. But those were positive signs. It's good to see that there's more manufacturing going on.
You know, I think there's some connection between these two things too. If you connect or talk about the Fed and what they're doing, and then you kind of go, well, wait a minute, so we got housing was a little better this week and industrial production was up a little bit, and you go, well, there's been money out there. You know, is it because the Fed lowered rates, you know, and anticipated lowering them again this week, or is there some other factor, perhaps confidence or lack of fear in some other aspect that allowed people to feel better and spend that money? And I think therein lies whether the Fed at this stage in the game really is influencing the economy, or whether that impact has been somewhat diminished, and whether there are indeed other factors, maybe some gaining confidence that things aren't going to be as bad as they thought they might be, which is giving some rise to some additional building of homes and in production.
Kyle, Joel mentioned our seminars. We held our all-client seminars the last couple weeks. And one of the things that Bob Landis talked about was, in pretty much detail, growth stocks, the chase of growth versus value, discrepancies in valuations. Bring us up to speed on what he talked about.
Yeah, no, I think the big takeaway from the seminar, at least for me, when you look at value and growth, is this idea that for so long growth stocks have been the winner, you know, at least for the past couple of years. And really, if you look over the last 30 years, now growth outperforming value, very much on the back of what's happened the last few years. And so, you know, I think just from the outset, that might, you know, tell the typical investor, oh, we should be leaning more into growth because look how well it's doing. And then I think when you start to really figure out, okay, how do we price this stuff? Obviously, we're willing to pay a little more for growth than we are for value because, you know, growth stocks have the opportunity to really shine in most positive markets and most markets that are growing. And I think the challenge is, what are we paying for growth right now? And the truth is probably a little more than we should be paying. When you look at long-term averages, growth pretty overpriced relative to those long-term averages. And then you look at value and you go, okay, well, value is supposed to be cheaper, but even compared to what that average cheap looks like, we're about average right now for value stocks. And so I think, you know, if you're just looking at valuations and going, where's the opportunity, it might tell you to lean a little more into value. And then you bring in all the other conversations about value stocks, right? The idea that most value stocks pay a dividend. And so if you're looking at what can I get on a 10-year treasury right now, or what can I get on the overnight lending rate now that they've lowered it again, realistically, probably do a little better buying dividend-paying stocks than you can buying that bond if you can afford a little bit or if you can be patient enough to see that stock price bounce around. And then, you know, lastly, of course, I think if we're concerned about the direction of markets long-term, it's those value stocks that tend to hold up a little better. And so, you know, for all those reasons, as Bob mentioned at the seminar, I think as everybody here sitting around the table has had conversations with their clients, one of the things we've been talking about is, you know, maybe now's the time to lean a little more into that area of the market. After years of leaning into growth and benefiting from the opportunities that were in growth stocks, you know, we're starting to unwind that a little bit.
Isabel, what were some of the other big takeaways you had from the seminar? Are we headed for a recession?
I was going to say, you know, I think a lot of people have been really worried about when the next recession is going to happen. And Bob really painted a picture of a little bit more of sluggish growth, at least in the near future, and gave us a few reasons for optimism. The one that really stuck out for me was consumer spending. You know, we all know that consumer spending is one of the main drivers of our economy, and consumers are still looking good right now. You know, households are sitting on healthy balance sheets, and unemployment is still hovering its 50-year low, which is noted in our economic indicators this week. But of course, take this with a grain of salt. There's many factors that can contribute to a recession, and they're very difficult to predict. So at the end of the day, you know, we always say just think long term and make sure you're positioned appropriately for whatever may be coming our way.
Yeah, you know, I think that was a great point about looking long-term. One of the slides that struck me at the seminar was looking back and looking past the recession. Since the end of 1929, a 75% chance of profit in the stock market for all one-year periods, a 98% chance of profiting for all 10-year periods, and you go out to 15 years, and this is a rolling, so any rolling 1 or 10 or 15 year period, at 15 years is a 100% chance that you'll be profitable in the stock market. So it really is all about time in the market, not timing the market as we so often talk about.
And Mark, just to put a plug in, if Max can plug Razzmatazz, just to remind listeners that we, as usual, we'll be posting a video of the seminar, and we're working on that now. So check back in a week or so, and keep checking our website, Landis.com.
Kyle, I had a question from one of the attendees at the seminar about negative bond yields. Of course, we don't have negative bond yields in this country yet, and I don't think we will, but one never knows. But there's something on the order of $17 trillion of bonds worldwide with a negative yield. The attendee asked what effect that might have on bond funds and on their bond, their accounts that hold bonds. What would you say to that client?
Yeah, you know, I think the big thing to remember is that the vast majority of that negative yielding debt is government debt. It's not the debt of corporations around the world. And so when you're looking at your underlying investments, when you're looking at your bond funds, if all you're doing is buying a passive indexed bond fund, you probably have a lot of government debt, and that would cause you some concern should we get negative rates here. Even looking at global indexes, you know, there's a lot of technical issues that come into an investment that includes those negative bonds, and how do you capture the payment that you have to make to purchase that bond instead of being made a payment from having that bond, and does it show up in expenses? Does it just reduce the yield that you get? You know, these are a lot of questions that the good news is most investors will never have to answer, because in active management, you're not limited to those negative yielding bonds. And so especially in the bond market, we've tended to favor active management. I think the good news there is that, you know, they can go out and find some really high quality corporate bonds that aren't negative yielding. Yeah, there were a couple of corporates in the EU that ended up going negative as well. But for the most part, you know, positive yields there. And so I think the most important point is that bond investors, even in mutual funds, aren't going to have to be limited to those negative yielding bonds. And then I think that the second piece is, I believe it's highly unlikely that we get there here in the U.S. There's just a lot of hurdles that we'd have to overcome should we get that far. And so I think, we've got quite a bit of cushion here still. There's a lot of reasons why it shouldn't be a concern. And then you add in that active managers' hands aren't going to be tied to that negative debt. And I think for the most part, there's not too much to be concerned about there.
Another speaker at our seminar was Dave Sandstrom, and he talked about a new law that's working its way through Congress, and it looks like it probably will get all the way to the president's desk, and he'll sign it. It's called the SECURE Act, and it's an acronym for Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement. And I think it's something that our clients should be aware of, our listeners should be aware of. It's already passed the House almost unanimously. It's currently in the Senate. There's both good and bad in it. The good news is that there would no longer be IRA limits on age. You can make a contribution no matter how old you are if you continue to work. And also that the age for taking your required minimum distribution would be raised from 70 and a half to 72. The downside is that currently, if somebody inherits your IRA, they can stretch that IRA over their lifetime. That will go away unless it's a spousal beneficiary who can still do that. Somebody else, a child, a grandchild, would have to liquidate that IRA within 10 years. And you can see that might cause a problem for some people, especially if they're in their prime earning years and they inherit an IRA. They're going to have to liquidate it in 10 years and pay taxes at the high rate that they're paying, on their ordinary income. So, has not passed yet, but it certainly looks like it will, and just something to keep an eye on and talk to your advisor about if you have any concerns or questions on how that works.
And Mark, I think worth pointing out that there was a competing bill in the Senate prior to the House approving the SECURE Act or passing the SECURE Act, and so I think there's some reconciliation that will still need to be done. And so, anytime I'm addressing a 2B bill as opposed to something that's already passed, I think it's important to remember that until the Senate approves it, we have no idea what it's really going to look like. Other than that, we can be pretty confident that there's some provisions in there that are going to change the way your IRA distributions happen.
As Yogi Berra said, it ain't over till it's over.
Correct.
And with that, we thank you for listening to another edition of Money Talk. The listenership keeps growing. We enjoy doing the show. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.